This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Keri Phillips, and this is Rear Vision. This week, voters in the Philippines will elect a new president. It will almost certainly be the son of a corrupt dictator forced to flee the country.
Five key candidates are vying for the presidency. The frontrunner is Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos, son of the dictator and his namesake who ruled the Philippines for more than 20 years until the late 80s. Others include the now vice president and the only woman candidate, Lenny Robredo, boxer Manny Pacquiao, and Manila's mayor, Isko Moreno. All five have vowed to revive the country's COVID-battered economy. President Duterte, like all presidents, is restricted to a single six-year term. His daughter, Sara Duterte, is running for vice president.
If Ferdinand Marcos Jr. wins the election, as expected, it will be a most remarkable comeback for a family thought to have stolen between $5 and $10 billion before being forced into exile. He'll succeed President Rodrigo Duterte, whose 6 years in office have been filled with controversies of their own.
If some of his pre-election rhetoric is anything to go by, then the Philippines is in for a tumultuous ride over the next 6 years after the inauguration today of Rodrigo Duterte. The authoritarian firebrand has promised to wage a war on crime, including plans to reintroduce the death penalty, issuing shoot-to-kill orders to the security services and offering them bounties for the bodies of drug dealers.
Do not destroy our children because I will kill you, simply. Do not destroy my country, I'll kill you.
President Duterte has made a record of sorts. He's the first president to remain popular even in his last year in office, since polling began. Hello, I'm Marites Vitug. I'm an editor-at-large of Rappler, a leading news website in the Philippines. So that's a record, and it's a phenomenon that we're trying to understand. But we have some explanation. Number one, it's his personality. He is seen as authentic, folksy, you know, with a sense of humor. When he talks to people, he doesn't have any pretensions. Even the cursing, I think some people like the way he curses, the rough jokes, and also his populist style of leadership. Duterte is known for being autocratic. He has been one of the least transparent presidents. He has refused to disclose his asset statement, which is required by the law. You know, how much money you make, what are your businesses, you have to declare your family's business interests. And of course, he has sent one of his critics to jail on trumped up charges, that's Senator Laila de Lima. He has intimidated the independent media, and he has encouraged his allies in Congress to shut down the largest TV network in the country. And he has gone after independent media. He has used state agencies to go after independent media. For example, Rappler, where I work, the Bureau of Internal Revenue has filed a case against Rappler for not paying enough taxes, you know, things like that. It's not black and white. It's not state censorship, but it's trying to squeeze independent media. And in the process, weakening free expression in the Philippines.
Well, the record about his drug war really has been the focus of everybody's attention. Hello, I'm Patricio Abinales. I'm a professor at the Department of Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. The debate is how many people were killed. Human rights groups say 30,000 people have been killed. The government says only 6,000. But what is clear is the majority of the people killed are poor, from the poor. Rarely is somebody from the rich or the middle class targeted for assassination. So that's the main thing. But he leaves behind a very peculiar legacy because the people that he kills are also the people he supports much. The budget of Duterte for social welfare has been the highest since 1986. Social welfare now constitutes about 16.7% of the budget. I mean, he's continued a program that his predecessor, whom he dislikes, started. He has also institutionalized a temporary program that his predecessors had with World Bank support, which is the conditional cash transfer for the poor. World Bank used to give $43 million a year for this program. What Duterte had done is to institutionalize it, to make it part of the government budget. And therefore, the succeeding presidents cannot take it away. The third thing that he did was universal health care, which he passed into a law in February 2019, followed by free education in public schools and universities. And so you have this really weird contradiction where the people that he targets, you know, the section of the population that he targets, are also the section of the population which has received a large percentage of the government's budget. And he has done this despite the fact that, say, in public education, free public education, the government will be spending $2 billion a year. And people are saying it cannot be sustained. So that's the first thing about Duterte. It's a really interesting contradiction with him as the president responsible for 30,000 suspected people involved in the drug trade dying, but also a government that has really given significant portion of its budget to the poor.
In the Philippines, a president is limited to a single six-year term, so Duterte can't run again. This week, Filipinos will be electing a president and a vice president, although they don't need to be running on a joint ticket. The frontrunners are a team, though. Duterte's daughter, Sara, for vice president, and Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos leading the presidential hopefuls.
There are a range of candidates running, five major candidates, but really for our purposes, we can focus on the top two. Hello, I'm Paul Hutchcroft, professor in the Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University. That is Bongbong Marcos running for president alongside Mayor Sara Duterte of Davao City, the daughter of the current president, Rodrigo Duterte. And Bongbong Marcos, of course, is the son of the conjugal dictatorship of Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos that were in power, first of all, in a constitutional period starting in 1965, reelected in 1969, and then Ferdinand Marcos declared martial law in 1972 and remained in power as part of a very brutal authoritarian regime that then got ousted in February of 1986. One particularity of the Philippine electoral system is that the president and the vice president are elected separately, but both as separate candidates are doing very well in the polls. The most recent data we have is that Bongbong Marcos is at 56% of the total. He is running against the person who defeated him in 2016 for the vice presidency, and that is Leni Robredo. She is a politician that comes out of the more liberal democratic mode of Philippine politics and is the widow of a very popular politician who was really kind of the exemplar of good governance as he was mayor of a small city in Southeast Luzon from 1988, running all the way through to 2010, at which point he became the Secretary of Interior and Local Government. Those are the major two candidates, and Leni Robredo has the momentum at this point, but has a long, long ways to go, and it would take nothing short of a miracle for her to close that gap. Other candidates include the former boxing champion, now Senator Manny Pacquiao, who has been polling more in the range of 6 to 8%, as well as a former police director who's down in the range of 2%, and a former mayor of Manila, who was polling about 6 to 8% also, but the general view is that his campaign has imploded a fair bit and he's going to be coming down in the polls. So those are the major candidates that are vying for the presidency in the May 9 elections. The other thing to point out is that the Philippine electoral system only requires a plurality of the votes. Whoever gets the most votes wins. This is unlike what we've recently seen in France, where there's a two-round election. So a small plurality can win the election. But at this point, we have Bongbong Marcos getting survey results that suggest support of more than a majority of the population. This is unprecedented in Philippine politics across the broad swath of democratic elections since the fall of his father in 1986.
Professor Abinales says that Sara Duterte is a popular candidate for vice president.
First, she has projected this image of a strong personality like her father. There's a YouTube video of her punching an official of the National Housing Commission, which everybody in Manila, in the capital and elsewhere, disapproved of. But in her city, when she was mayor, 99% of her voters supported that. The second one is Sara is completely different from her father. I mean, she's the daughter of his first wife. And therefore, Filipinos, you know, have this tendency of supporting the children of the first family. So I am my father, but I am also not my father. The third thing is Sara comes from the South. People from the South who speak a particular language, the second largest language in the country, it's Visayan, voted wholeheartedly for the father. And Sara, the daughter, is already topping that. So this Visayan-speaking population constitute over two-thirds of the central Philippines, and then another two-thirds also of the southern island of Mindanao. So it's a very, very big voting bloc. It's been instrumental in putting precedents since 2000. And so this is what her father did, tapped on this, and that's what Sara has been doing also in her campaigns.
Despite his daughter running for election with Ferdinand Marcos Jr., President Duterte has been critical of him, publicly accusing him, without actually naming him, of being a drug addict.
Rodrigo Duterte, like any president, wanted to have some influence on who might be his successor. And he had a particular interest in trying to make sure that the next president would give him some kind of immunity from prosecution. Of course, under Duterte, his so-called war on drugs has led to the death of thousands of Filipinos, particularly urban poor. So he needs to have the next president be favorably disposed towards him and protect him from prosecution, whether from the International Criminal Court or from domestic prosecution. Now, his goal throughout the latter part of 2021 was one of two close allies that he would have wanted to see become the next president. First, most obviously, his daughter, Sara Duterte, the mayor of Davao City, and she would have been his pick for the top of the slate. But as it turned out, it was, in political terms, terrible timing. Couldn't have been worse timing for a family spat between the father and the daughter. And the daughter did not want to play by the rule book that her father was hoping to impose. And she ended up bolting and becoming the vice presidential candidate under Bongbong Marcos. This made the father very, very upset because his daughter was doing better in the polls than was Bongbong Marcos at the time. So when the two of those major politicians got together, that's Bongbong Marcos at the top of the ticket and Sara settling for the bottom of the ticket, the president went on a bit of a rampage against someone whom he did not name, but it was clearly someone who fit the profile of Bongbong Marcos, speaking of the only son of a former president who was a weak leader and a cocaine addict. He really pulled out all stops in going after the person that his daughter had ended up running with.
This is Radio National's Rear Vision with Keri Phillips. Don't forget to look for us on the ABC Listen app. As voters in the Philippines elect new leaders, we're tracking the extraordinary political revival of the Marcoses, a family that rorted billions of dollars before being forced to flee the country. Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos, the son of the former dictator, is likely to become the next president of the Philippines. Ferdinand Marcos Sr. was elected president in 1965, ruling largely under martial law after 1971. During his regime, thousands of suspected communist rebels and political foes were arrested, tortured, or killed, and the economy was driven into the ground.
The first 2 years, they say, were quite productive, but after that, it was downhill. So I'm Teresa Encarnacion Tadem. I'm a professor of political science at the University of the Philippines, Diliman. Economically, we were the basket case of the region of Southeast Asia. Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, interesting, they also had dictatorships, but they were new Asian tigers by the 1980s. The Philippines was nowhere there. So that one, no economic development. The business community was basically conservative, and business community will not mind whether it's authoritarian or not, as long as they're able to get what they want. And they saw that the cronies were getting the bigger slice of the pie. I think they've already said, okay, corruption, fine, it happens in society. But when the economic crisis was kicking in, so the pie for giving to cronies became smaller and smaller, it started getting from the share of the non-cronies. So this is when they started to talk and say, hey, wait a minute, why are you favoring the cronies when you have to rescue corporations? Why are you rescuing the crony corporations? So this all added to the anti-Marcos dictatorship. And it's very well documented. It's very well documented. That's why it's quite appalling that you have a lot of videos and revisionisms, even in history books, about what they call the golden years of the martial law years. I think prompting the UP School of Economics just to come out just last year with a paper that says, hey, no, it's all written up. Here's all our debt, the biggest debt ever we had, biggest debt and underdevelopment and poverty.
In February 1986, the People Power Revolution forced the Marcos family into exile in Hawaii. They left behind evidence of their opulent lifestyle on full display once the new president, Corazon Aquino, opened the presidential palace to the public.
People from depressed areas, the slums, witnessed for themselves the gross extravagance of the former first family. They passed the gigantic bed of Imelda Marcos, with the grand piano nearby and the 14-carat gold wash basin. And the clothes, 3,000 pairs of shoes and gowns, 35 racks full. People whose daily lives are occupied in finding enough food to stay alive saw evidence of one of the most extraordinary lifestyles, riches beyond their imaginations.
Ferdinand Marcos Sr. died in Hawaii in 1989, and the family was allowed to return to the Philippines in 1992. That same year, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. was elected to Congress, the first step in the rehabilitation of the Marcos name.
What they did since they returned was also to establish networks with former allies, former friends among the political and business elite. Hello, I'm Ella Atienza. I'm a professor of political science at the University of the Philippines in Diliman, Quezon City. And in the process, they were able to also promote a better version of themselves, starting with mainstream media and at the same time also with the advent of social media. Later on, they managed to invest a lot of money in reinventing themselves, retelling and revising the history. They presented the Marcos martial law years as golden years, even if, of course, academic data and data both from civil society groups in the Philippines and government and non-government data from outside the Philippines prove otherwise. And of course, they entered into alliances with other political families. They supported candidates for president, including President Duterte. So there are some people who, well, younger people who have no memory of martial law. There are people who have not really paid much attention to the human rights violations and the economic dislocations created by the martial law regime.
There's 1.67 million Filipino voters. 31% of that are voters between the ages 18 to 40. And what's interesting about this generation is the oldest of them was born in 1982, and were 4 years old when Marcos fell from power. And it's aggravated by the fact that the national government since 1986 has never really made any effort of educating Filipinos on what happened in the 15 years of the Marcos dictatorship. And this allowed the Marcoses an opening in which they would try to resurrect themselves. And one of the targets they did as far back as the 1990s was to try to publicize, to try to engage a long-term propaganda campaign that would resurrect and rehabilitate the image of the family.
The short answer is that it's been going on for a very long time. The Marcoses have been working assiduously to try to rehabilitate their name. The lack of central direction in terms of textbooks has allowed them to put in language into many textbooks at the primary and secondary level that speak of the Marcos era as the golden years of the Philippines. And it's important to keep in mind that in this electorate of the Philippines coming into the May 9th elections, 56% of the electorate is between the age of 18 and 41. So these are many young people that would not have personal memories of the Marcos years and thus can be particularly susceptible to these glorification, this falsification that is taking place in social media. And this has come through, in particular, YouTube and TikTok. And your listeners need only look at YouTube and see some of the glorification of the Marcos years that's come about. And on top of the glorification, there's also an appeal to younger people through these chats that Ferdinand Marcos Jr. or Bongbong Marcos has with his son, who is running for elective office in their home province. And the two have these, the chats, almost a showbiz quality to it in terms of trying to bring the appeal of a father and a son that have a jocular relationship, and the son remembering fondly his grandmother, Imelda, Mommy Melda, and how she used to bring me chocolates. And I mean, this is not sophisticated political discourse by any means. This is very chatty, vacuous stuff, but it has an enormous appeal.
Imelda Marcos is still alive, isn't she?
Yes, she is. She's, I think, 92 years old, born in 1930, and remains an important figure in the background for Bongbong Marcos. She is the one that has long dreamed of her son becoming president and coming after her husband. Bongbong Marcos is by no means the most diligent or smartest politician among the children, but Imelda has favored the son over a daughter politician, Aimee Marcos, a current senator who is far more diligent, has many more achievements in the political realm than does her brothers.
Despite the current spat between President Duterte and Bongbong Marcos, during his first year in office, Duterte granted his father a hero's burial. The former dictator's embalmed body had been on display in a mausoleum in his hometown in the northern Philippines.
Under a shroud of secrecy, a dictator is laid to rest among the nation's war heroes and past presidents.
Marcos is a hero!
But not everyone's cheering for Ferdinand Marcos, who was buried with full military honours. Earlier this month, victims and relatives of those who suffered under his rule went to the Supreme Court to strike down an order by President Rodrigo Duterte for Marcos's body to be moved to the Heroes Cemetery south of Manila. But their attempts failed.
In Filipino politics, it's the family, not the party, that matters.
The Philippine political system now is a system of fat political dynasties. Over 80% of local politics are controlled by political families. So in a weird sense, the Philippine political system is very stable because each region, each province, each locality is controlled by a particular political family, where positions, official positions that are electable positions, are musical chairs. Okay, father runs for parliament. Wife runs for governor of the province, son goes become mayor of the city. When father's term limit ends, wife takes over the parliament. Father runs for governor of the province. Sons become, you know, runs for a seat for the lower house of the parliament. So it's all musical chair. And the interesting thing about this is that the former portrait, the old portrait of Philippine politics, as a politics where guns, goons, and gold dominate, where violence is always extremely high during election campaigns, that has completely gone down. It means that political families are very comfortable with their control at the local level. And if there are rivals, this is what they do. They just divide a certain province and create a new one.
It has a long history, but the family is now replacing, in my view, the political party in the Philippines. It's whom you know. It's the family name that you're familiar with. People do not question these dynasties. In fact, there has been an anti-dynasty bill pending in Congress, which has never been approved. It goes contrary to the interests of those in Congress to pass an anti-dynasty bill. So the children of the old political parents have been modernized. They've gone to better schools. They've better exposure. And so now they take over from where their parents or aunties or uncles left off. So they call themselves a modernized generation, younger generation of dynastic families.
And if you don't have a family name, you need to be a celebrity? Isn't a famous boxer also running for president?
Yes, we have. Actually, Manny Pacquiao, of course, is a well-known champion in boxing, but he already parlayed his popularity into politics when he ran for Congress and won, then ran for Senate and won, and didn't do well. He was always absent because of his boxing matches. The other celebrity who's running for the presidency is a former movie actor, Isko Moreno, who also parlayed his popularity into local politics when he became mayor of Manila.
What might the future hold under another President Marcos?
The short answer is we don't know. Marcos was not a senator of any great achievement. So when people want to understand what the dynamics of the next presidency might be, should Marcos indeed win the election, they look to the potential influence of these three important women in his life. Imelda at age 92, the actuarial tables suggest that she may not be around forever, but in particular, the sister, Aimee, and the wife, Lisa, and what kind of goals that they may bring in. Frankly, we just don't know whether Marcos has the diligence to project any strong program of his own. We don't even know if he has the diligence to replicate the acquisitive crony capitalism of his father. He really has relied in his campaign on just an appeal to unity, that the country's politics has become too polarized, there's too much anger out there. It's important to come together, and he calls his team Unity Team.
Professor Paul Hutchcroft from the Coral Bell School of Asia Pacific Affairs at the ANU. The other guests were Patricio Abinales, who, although he grew up in the Philippines, is now a professor at the School for Pacific and Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Maritas Vitug, editor-at-large of Rapala, the Philippine news website, and Professor Ella Atienza and Professor Teresa Tadam, political scientists from the University of the Philippines. Simon Branthwaite is the sound engineer for this Rear Vision. Thanks for listening. Bye from Keri Phillips.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.